There's a Greek legend about a peasant who was brought before the king, for reasons that don't matter much to the story, and naturally began rhapsodizing about how great the king had it compared to his miserable peasant life. The king agreed that, yes, having all these servants and nice food and stuff is nice, but do you want to trade places for a day? The king then had the peasant sit in his throne, with access to all the riches in the palace, but above his head, the king hung a sword, dangling by a single horsehair. That, said the king, is the danger you face by being in a much desired position of power. Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. But if you think heads of state have the right to be paranoid, the most rightfully paranoid people on earth are, naturally, spies. These are people who traffic in lies for a living, people whose whole career is about not being who they seem. If you're sending out people to infiltrate other countries' intelligence agencies, and they get in, at some point you have to realize this must be happening the opposite way, too. Who here around me is a mole? Even if the answer is nobody, you can never be sure. But it's possible to get too paranoid. To get so paranoid that you become a danger to yourself and others, a danger to your geopolitical enemies and allies alike. This is the story of the CIA leader who became so paranoid, even everyone else carrying out Cold War witch hunts thought he was crazy. A man who, despite his messianic middle name, carried more of a demonic presence within his own agency. This is the story of James Jesus Angleton. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian and Thimble the Doll, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. It's Tuesday, so another new tradition on this channel, Lie of the Week. I said I'd be doing this in my Q&A, so here we are on the Tor's Cabinet Discord, which you can access by donating to the Tor's Cabinet Patreon. There is a channel simply called Lies. Jenny Girl says, in basketball, the ball is alive and doesn't like being thrown around like that. You've ruined basketball for me, Jenny. Get on that channel and start lying, people, because right now the Lies channel has just turned into conversations about drugs, which is what most of the Tor's Cabinet Discord usually is. Do that on the other channels. It's a lying channel. Speaking of lies and the Discord, thank you, Amanita, for this episode's title. Amanita on the Discord told me a few weeks ago that she had a dream I made a video called The Lord of Lies. A bit more abstract than my typical titles, but I was like, that goes hard. It fits with the ending quote of this episode. I'm gonna use it. James Jesus Angleton was born December 9, 1917, in Boise, Idaho. His father was James Hugh Angleton, a U.S. Army cavalry officer, and his mother was the Mexican-born Carmen Mercedes Moreno, so his middle name was probably pronounced Jesus, although once he entered the U.S. Civil Service, he pronounced it Jesus. As a child, due to his father's military career, Angleton was raised in Milan, Italy, and later sent to Malvern College, which was a boarding school in England. He attended Yale University to study poetry and served as one of the co-editors to Yale's literary magazine, Furioso. While at university, he became pen pals with all the most notable American poets of the time, Ezra Pound, Robert Frost, and T.S. Eliot. Angleton was an ardent follower of the New Criticism method, which was a literary theory that emphasized close and careful readings of writings to find their true meaning. This would influence how he managed his counterintelligence operations for the CIA. In March 1943, he joined the U.S. Army. While in the Army, he served in the Office of Strategic Services, a precursor to the CIA, in their London office. At the OSS, Angleton worked in counterintelligence, focusing on the intelligence operations in Italy. It was during his time at OSS that he made one of his closest friends and mentors, a British MI6 intelligence officer named Harold Kim Philby. Kim was a scion of the British elite and educated in Cambridge. His father had given him the nickname Kim from the Rudyard Kipling book by the same name, about an Indian boy who became a spy in colonial-era India. During World War II, Philby was in MI6 Section D, which focused on attacking enemies through non-military means and training saboteurs. After a tour of duty there, MI6 moved him to Section 5, which dealt in counterintelligence, where he became a mentor to Angleton. Philby preferred Angleton because he had, quote, quiet good manners. Whereas most Americans Philby worked with, he described as fawning Anglophiliacs. In 1944, Angleton was transferred to Italy to manage secret counterintelligence, which focused on intelligence derived from Ultra, signals intelligence from encrypted German intelligence like the Enigma machine, which Alan Turing basically invented computer science in order to decipher. After World War II ended, the OSS was dissolved and spun off into two different intelligence agencies, the Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and the Central Intelligence Agency. Angleton was transferred to the CIA and remained in Italy to make sure that the US-backed Christian Democratic Party defeated the Italian Communist Party in the 1948 Italian elections. By the way, this is something that the US had to keep doing in every Italian election. All the way up until the fall of the USSR, the Italian Communist Party was the most powerful communist party in the Western world and always the runner-up in Italian elections. In response, all the other parties organized into a catch-all big tent party called the Christian Democrats, who were pretty all over the place in terms of ideology, since they included everyone who wasn't a communist, but they can best be described as fiscally progressive and socially conservative. Like, the Christian Democrats were officially Catholic-aligned and anti-abortion and everything, but also took Jesus' teachings on helping the poor seriously. Because if you didn't, they'd vote communist. The US probably didn't intervene in Italian elections in the sense of, like, stuffing ballot boxes, overt fraud, but they definitely put their thumb on the scale in terms of financial and media support for the Christian Democrats, same as the USSR was putting their thumb on the scale in support of the communists. The communists never won a majority government in Italy, but they came close a bunch of times. So even though people outside Italy don't really think of it this way, Italy was a major theater of the Cold War. There's a great video essay I have linked in the description about the Years of Lead, a period of political instability in the 1970s, when the Cold War broke out into open violence committed by far-left and far-right militias, the former prime minister was killed by left-wing terrorists. It was a crazy time, and I feel like the geopolitical role of Italy in the Cold War doesn't get talked about enough. Anyway, in 1949, Angleton was moved to DC, where he served as the head of Staff A, which was within the Office of Special Operations. He managed foreign intelligence and served as a liaison officer with the Israeli Mossad. During his time on the Israeli desk, he worked to create an Israeli spy network that he could use to recruit Soviet defectors throughout Eastern Europe and the USSR. While in this position, Angleton worked closely with his World War II mentor Kim Philby, who had also moved to DC, to serve as the first secretary of the British Embassy, though this was a cover for his real role as British intelligence representative to the CIA. Philby and Angleton would have weekly lunches together in Washington. While living in DC, Philby's housemate was a man named Guy Burgess, a fellow Cambridge classmate who previously worked in the BBC and the Home Office. Burgess was also openly gay, or at least as open as you could be in those times. Angleton described himself as half amused, half appalled with Burgess's, quote, exuberant style. However, when he would invite them over to his house, Angleton's daughter, Siri Hari Angleton, remarked how they frolicked. They'd start chasing each other through the house in this little choo-choo train. These men in their Eton ties, screaming and laughing. I know what you're thinking, but Kim Philby probably wasn't gay. He was a known womanizer who went through several wives and cheated on each of them with high-class women. He could have been bi. I don't think it's crazy to suggest that Philby and Burgess had a liaison beyond a strong friendship, but then again, it's okay for men to have strong friendships. This was the state of things in the post-war years, perhaps the only happy years of Angleton's life, before he discovered something else about Philby that would ruin the lives of both of them, and far more. The Soviet Union recruited Philby while he studied at Cambridge in the 1930s, just like they recruited Burgess. The spies recruited at Cambridge University were known as the Cambridge Spy Ring. In 1945, a Soviet cipher clerk accidentally reused a one-time cipher pad to transmit a coded message. Having two messages to compare, the code was cracked by British intelligence, revealing that there was a mole working inside the British embassy in DC, who the Soviets referred to by the codename Homer. Homer was traveling to New York twice a week to meet his Soviet handlers. Philby knew the Soviet agent, a fellow Cambridge school friend, Donald McLean, who was working at the British embassy at the time, and he had to protect McLean's cover. As Philby was attempting to delay McLean's exposure, a fellow Cambridge spy ring member, Guy Burgess, was sent to serve as the second secretary at the British embassy. This was because Burgess had a reputation of being, quote, unstable, alcoholic, and frequently flaunted social norms. Burgess caused many issues to Philby's intelligence operations in DC, to the point that he was on J. Edgar Hoover's radar, who noted that he was using British embassy cars to avoid getting arrested for his, quote, homosexual encounters. Homosexuality was seen as a security risk for black male, and same-sex relationships were an aberration and indicator of weakness. Being gay could cost your security clearance, and this process was not ended in the United States until Bill Clinton issued an executive order in 1996. This could still be revoked at any time. Despite this, gay people were probably overrepresented in the intelligence services of the time. J. Edgar Hoover himself was probably gay. If you were gay in those days, you were naturally good at concealing things about yourself, a good skill for a spy or an investigator. You had to be able to move countries and live under the radar for years at the drop of a hat if you were a spy, and that was easier if you had no immediate family and less of a social life. Again, if you were gay in those days, that would probably be true. And I feel like autism plays a role too. Spies are more likely to be autistic types, autistic people are more likely to be queer, QED. By 1951, Philby had to work to smuggle McLean out of the UK and get Burgess out of the United States before McLean was interrogated by the Secret Intelligence Service. On May 25th, Burgess smuggled McLean onto a steamship that would take him to France and later Moscow. What Philby did not expect was for Burgess to join McLean in defecting to Moscow. When Burgess and McLean went missing, it became an international incident, with news reporting that two British diplomats had shockingly defected to the Soviet Union. Philby was interrogated by MI5 to ascertain if he was the third man in this spy ring, which he was. Philby denied that he was a Soviet agent and later resigned from MI6 in July 1951. Philby gave a famous press conference in October 1955 stating he had never been a communist and was formally cleared on November 7th by the Foreign Secretary Harold Macmillan, who became Prime Minister not much later.
Mr. Harold Philby, on the right, holds a press conference to deny charges that he was involved in the disappearance of Burgess and McLean.
The Burgess-McLean affair has raised issues of great delicacy.
Can you say when your communist associations ended, if I assume they did?
The last time I spoke to a communist, knowing that he was a communist, was sometime in 1934.
After Philby lost his access to classified material, the Soviets ceased using him as an agent. Philby disappeared off to Beirut to work as a journalist, hoping to get back into the intelligence game. Angleton still supported Philby, insisting that he could still become the head of the British service and did not believe that his friend was a Soviet spy all along. While Philby was working as a journalist, MI6 took him back, allowing him to travel throughout the Middle East and pass reports to MI6 and then the Soviets. In January 1963, Philby finally went mask off and defected to the Soviet Union. This defection destroyed Angleton. Nicholas Elliott, Philby's best friend at MI6, described Angleton and Philby's relationship as far beyond any routine relationship between the colleagues of two friendly countries. The knowledge that he, Angleton, the top expert in the world of Soviet espionage, had been totally deceived had a cataclysmic effect. Philby viewed his mentee Angleton as a brilliant opponent and fascinating friend. John McCrager, a CIA colleague of both Philby and Angleton, said that the key to Philby, if there was a single one, is in a compulsion to betray and deceive, which underlay all his relationships. Philby later remarked how easy it was to steal secrets from the British, saying he had made friends with the archivist who managed the files and went drinking with him, regularly allowing him to get access to the files he had no reason to be allowed to see. Philby says, if there had been proper discipline in the handling of papers, that would have been quite impossible. But there was, in fact, no discipline. Philby would leave his office every evening with a big briefcase full of reports and turn them over to his Soviet contact, who would return them the next day. He did this year in, year out. Philby claimed that the reason no one suspected him was due to the British class system, which could not accept someone from his elite standing would be a traitor, and MI6 would have too much to lose if he was proven a spy. December 18th, 1961, a Soviet KGB officer within the Strategic Planning Department, Anatoly Golitsyn, defected to the CIA via Finland. What Golitsyn provided to the CIA was evidence that there were KGB moles inside the CIA. This revelation consumed Angleton. Angleton viewed Golitsyn's defection as the most valuable defector to ever reach the West. Golitsyn also provided information to the CIA regarding the identities of the Cambridge spy ring and double agents operating out of West Germany. Golitsyn claimed that the moles within the CIA had the KGB codename Sasha. This mole's real name, ended in Ski, began with K, was previously stationed in West Germany, and was of Slavic descent. Angleton's search for Sasha became his white whale. The intelligence community was divided regarding the information Golitsyn was supplying to the West. Christopher Andrew, the official historian of MI5, viewed him as an unreliable conspiracy theorist. For example, some of his claims were seen as pretty big stretches. Golitsyn provided information claiming that the Prime Minister of the UK, Harold Wilson, who knew my grandfather, the mathematician who was the original Tor Parsons, was a KGB informer and agent of influence. In addition, he said that the KGB was involved in poisoning Hugh Gaitskell, the preceding leader of the Labour Party who had died suddenly in 1963, to ensure that Wilson would become Prime Minister. MI5 counterintelligence investigated Wilson and cleared him, but there were those within British intelligence that viewed him as a potential KGB agent. According to the Mitrokhin archives, which were a collection of notes from KGB archivist Vasily Mitrokhin, who defected in 1992, the KGB had an agent development file with notes that they wanted to recruit Harold Wilson and thought it might be possible, and even gave him the codename Olding, but decided not to attempt to recruit Wilson. In 1964, Yuri Nosenko, a lieutenant colonel in the KGB based in Geneva, who was serving as a double agent to the CIA, was uncovered by the KGB. He reported to his CIA case officers that he wanted to defect. The CIA could not verify his KGB recall order to Moscow that caused Nosenko to issue his defection request. While being debriefed by the CIA, Nosenko made several shocking claims. One, that Golitsyn was not a genuine defector, he was a KGB mole who was feeding the CIA bad information, and two, he had information regarding the KGB's connection with Lee Harvey Oswald, the assassin of JFK, and his time living in the Soviet Union. Here we enter a state of affairs very much like the Spider-Man pointing meme. Everyone who says they're an American spy is a Soviet spy. Everyone who says they're a Soviet spy is an American spy. Everyone tries to deny it by going, no, you're the mole, and round it goes. The CIA began to suspect that Nosenko was actually a triple agent and a KGB plant. The first reason was when he admitted that he was actually a captain and not a lieutenant colonel. He stated that he had inflated his rank to ensure that he was more attractive to the CIA, though the documents he previously supplied showing his rank of lieutenant colonel were deemed authentic by the CIA. Was the CIA wrong? Was Nosenko lying? Yeah. Golitsyn also stated that the KGB would send people to discredit him, and there were those within the CIA, Angleton included, who thought that Nosenko fit the profile of who the KGB would send. There were now two people who claimed to be ex-KGB moles who were now helping the Americans, Golitsyn and Nosenko. Both of them were claiming the other one was a fake mole feeding them Soviet disinformation. Who was right? Possibly neither. Nosenko stated that the assertion from Golitsyn that the KGB had moles deep within the CIA was also not true. From 1964 to 67, Nosenko was kept in a CIA safe house in Clinton, Maryland, under the order of the CIA director John A. McCone, and was subjected to profoundly harsh interrogation methods and extensive solitary confinement. James Angleton was brought before the Warren Commission regarding the CIA's knowledge about the Kennedy assassination. Angleton noted that the information provided by Nosenko did not shake his belief in the bona fides of Golitsyn. However, on the other hand, J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director, and Richard Helms, director of the CIA, both strongly disagreed with Angleton's trust in Golitsyn. Hoover thought that Angleton's belief that the CIA and FBI were penetrated with moles was preposterous. On March 1, 1969, after numerous interrogations and failed polygraphs, Nosenko was found to be a genuine defector and given $80,000 in financial compensation and lived the rest of his life somewhere in the southern United States. It was later revealed that Nosenko provided information confirming John Vassal, a British civil servant who was caught in a homosexual honey trap, was a spy for the KGB. Vassal was already revealed earlier by Golitsyn. Nosenko's treatment was so harsh, it was one of the first abuses that were released under the CIA's Family Jewels documents in 1973. The director of Central Intelligence, Stansfield Turner, said the following. The excessively harsh treatment of Mr. Nosenko went beyond the bounds of propriety or good judgment. At my request, Mr. Hart has discussed this case with many senior officers to make certain that its history will not again be repeated. The other main lesson to be learned is that although counterintelligence analysis necessarily involves the making of hypotheses, we must at all times treat them as what they are and not act on them until they have been objectively tested in an impartial manner. If Nosenko was right, which was now the CIA's official line, then clearly Golitsyn wasn't. But Angleton still believed Golitsyn. Angleton remained committed during his tenure as chief of counterintelligence to finding the rumored Sasha. Angleton believed Golitsyn's assertions that the mole was working under the direction of a small cabal of puppet masters. His views of the mole fractured the CIA and caused conflict with the Directorate of Operations, managing clandestine services, who would regularly argue with Angleton regarding the efficiency of intelligence gathering and quizzing their knowledge of KGB tactics, techniques, and procedures. Angleton had let the intelligence enterprise get totally paralyzed by his paranoia. With the United States entering the Vietnam War, Angleton believed that the growing anti-war movement was actually funded and supported by the Soviet Union as a way to destabilize the United States. Angleton ordered the creation of Operation Chaos, which was one of the most comprehensive domestic counter-surveillance operations within the United States. It lasted from 1967 to 1974. Director of Central Intelligence Richard Helms informed President Johnson on November 15, 1967, that the CIA had found no evidence of contact between the most prominent peace movement leaders and foreign embassies in the U.S. or abroad. Operation Chaos continued throughout the Nixon administration until it was exposed by New York Times reporter Seymour Hersh in 1974. With that exposé, and Watergate at the same time, it was at the time a historic low for trust in government. Once Hersh's story was published, Angleton announced his resignation on Christmas Eve of 1974, stating that my usefulness had ended. Angleton's senior aides were retired shortly thereafter, and the counterintelligence department was reduced from 300 to 80 people. Angleton was awarded the Distinguished Intelligence Medal in 1975 and was quietly rehired as a contractor to manage, quote, operational issues. If he did anything important from there onward, the public as of yet has not heard about it. When Angleton was given a farewell luncheon at the CIA, he was asked if there was anything he had not yet disclosed about the Philby case. He replied heartbrokenly, "There are some matters I shall have to take to the grave with me, and Kim is one of them." Angleton's zeal and paranoia paralyzed the CIA. He did achieve various wins throughout the Cold War. His agent smuggled out the famous historic secret speech Nikita Khrushchev gave denouncing Stalin, which wasn't actually secret, it was just called that. And he uncovered a few real Soviet spies. Rudolf Abel, a KGB agent operating within the United States, George Blake, a British double agent, and George Pax, a NATO official. Angleton's obsession with the Soviet threat caused officials to ignore him and Amid the Cold War, sometimes when the boy cried out, there really was a wolf. The fact that the Soviets had bugged the typewriters within U.S. embassies in Moscow wasn't uncovered until the Reagan administration. Angleton recommended that people take counterintelligence more seriously when accepting Soviet gifts to be installed in the U.S. embassy in Moscow. The Soviets gave the U.S. embassy a giant carved wooden seal of the United States, which was found to have a microphone installed in it and wasn't discovered until by accident after being in the embassy for over 7 years. Angleton definitely got dealt a major told-you-so card by both those incidents. The Washington Post's Aaron Latham commented on his relationship with Angleton that Angleton was obsessed with T.S. Eliot's poem The Wasteland, which had turned poetry into a, quote, art form that was impenetrable to most people, and that Angleton had taken the same conclusion to the tradecraft of spying, creating, quote, involuted, convoluted, labyrinthine mazes, and got lost in its intricacies like modern poetry. In T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland, Eliot wrote of an unreal city in which one must be so careful these days. Bin gar keine Russin. I am not at all a Russian. And if you were accused by Angleton, he would likely never believe your pleas of innocence. Angleton remained paranoid and jingoistic until the bitter end. He told Aaron Latham in the 1980s, "The United States is going through a period now which is analogous to a period that the British went through 20 or so years ago when their young men wouldn't fight for the empire. It was during this period in British history that the Soviets recruited Guy Burgess and Donald MacLean and Kim Philby to spy for them. Also, it turned out there were real moles. And having the boy who cried moles around may have been what kept their covers from being blown. Angleton's witch hunt of fake moles led to the oversight which prevented the CIA and FBI from catching their own moles, Aldrich Amos in the 80s and Robert Hansen in the 90s, who were both working in Soviet counterintelligence as KGB double agents. Angleton also destroyed the careers of numerous innocent federal employees that he falsely accused in his hunt for the rumored Sasha. The CIA later paid compensation to the officers whose careers he ended. Angleton and Kim Philby ended their lives the same way, wasting away, consumed by alcoholism, in the respective capitals of the empires they had spied for, each believing they'd served their country as best they could and gotten a raw deal out of it. The KGB said they would make Philby a colonel once he defected, and he was only given a consultant job. He drank himself to death in Moscow. Angleton, in D.C., drank an estimated 150 to 200 bottles a week, still insisting he'd been right all along and was misunderstood by naive officers. Finally, before he died in 1987, Angleton showed a twinge of regret, but a bitter, aggrieved sense of regret, perhaps more a sense of anger at the whole paranoid world he'd been drawn into when he first became a spy. In his dying days, he gave journalist Joseph Trento a deathbed quote, harder than diamonds. Fundamentally, the founding fathers of U.S. intelligence were liars. The better you lied, and the more you betrayed, the more likely you would be promoted. Outside of their duplicity, the only thing they had in common was a desire for absolute power. I did things that in looking back on my life I regret. But I was part of it, and loved being in it. You were in a room full of people that you had to believe would deservedly end up in hell. I guess I will see them there soon."
Men in gray will get you now. You've got to hide or take the